This piece was brought to you by Roberta's, robertaspizza.com. I never had a reason to smile. I never had a number to dial.
I couldn't run a mile. Thought that love less. Engineer, we're back. Wow, tip-top organization here at HRN. That is not our theme song, but we are back on the main course. The main course was the first radio show ever to air in this studio, which is pretty amazing because we started with the dream of food not being a fashion, but not being covered as fluff. You know, food being a real serious issue, global warming, storms, famine, all that. It was getting short shift in the media. And so we started a radio station to counter that. And we started in 2009. And here we are in 2018, having logged probably around 12,000 shows across, you know, 35 weekly shows, 10,000 shows. And everyone shows up in the studio. It's not a podcast network. It is a radio station. So very, very exciting. We have a great show. I'm Patrick Martins. This is the main course. We're broadcasting out of Roberta's Brooklyn. In the studio with me is Elizabeth Greeley and Emily Pearson, our point guards.
Hello. Morning.
We have Mike Edison, host of Arts and Seizures.
I thought we were talking about marshmallow fluff today. That's
we
why
are,
I'm here.
We are. I'm Patrick. And our special guests are, we have two, both from the West Coast. They flew in just for the show.
And boy, are their arms
Not
tired.
True.
Not true. Jeff Mosher, the chef of Robert Mondavi Winery. Welcome, Jeff.
Yo, what's up, Patrick? Thanks for having me here today.
Yeah, no, we've known each other for over probably 15 years, and it's so great to see you in Brooklyn. I usually see you with the backdrop of a vineyard, so now you have a graffiti parking lot in the background. But and we also have Steve Marks, a longtime friend and meat distributor in Los Angeles, currently with Premier Meats. Welcome, Steve.
Great to be here.
And we have his lovely wife, Sharon, in the back, not participating, but she is here for moral support. So, Emily, let me
She's
take it away.
She's photographing us. She's a photographer. Look at that. Oh, very good. Important job.
Right. This is a fast show.
So I still dream of that thing, radio with pictures. I call it radio vision.
Any day now. All right. So we have fewer topics today, but a lot of guests. So let's jump right in. And Emily, you got the first one.
All right. So we know we love Meghan Markle around here. We want to talk about Polar Seltzer. Just announced it created a seasonal seltzer called Vanilla Zen. It is secretly inspired by Meghan Markle. But too bad for them. The royal family has already endorsed Hilden Natural Mineral Water with its royal warrant. Do you guys know what a royal warrant is?
I assume it means you have to go to jail.
No, not quite. It is basically the seal. You are allowed to put the seal on a product that you are endorsing. So if you had the power to grant a royal warrant to a food business, which one business or product would you choose? All right, Mike.
White Castle. Without a doubt, White Castle, because there's that, but it has to be a freestanding White Castle. As you know, it can't be part of a strip mall. It's got to be the freestanding, the kind of prefabricated, you know, White Castle building, like circa World Fair 1939, the ones that look like a men's room that's been turned inside out. You know what I'm talking about?
I mean, yes. We have a couple standalone ones in Brooklyn.
Yeah, there are a couple left still, and Queens is still kind of lousy with them. It's good, but White Castle, that's my vote. But I also want to say, enough of the seasonal stuff. There's no seasonal seltzer. It's not a thing.
It was just an excuse to make a new flavor. All right, Jeff, how about you?
You know what I'd like to see is I'd like to see some support for Brigade. So it's a company that's been around for a couple of years doing school lunches in a nutritious, chef-driven way. And that's definitely a problem in this country, and I think giving them some support to broaden, get it in more places. I think they're in the Bronx now in a couple different schools. It's not exactly a product, but it's the kind of thing that is food related and it needs work in this
country.
You
want the Queen to endorse it?
Yeah, sure.
Steve, you have one?
Of course, being from Southern California, it'd have to be In-N-Out Burger.
In-N-Out royal warrant for In-N-Out Burger.
That's more like an outstanding royal warrant.
I am, Steve, sorry, no offense. I am sick of hearing about In-N-Out. I don't think it's, the French fries are terrible. Terrible. McDonald's fries are a lot better. People talk about In-N-Out Burger. I don't know, is it sourced well? I don't know what
I think
the
it's all
is.
About that special sauce.
Yeah, I don't think sourcing
it's
is the... Sourced.
No, but I mean, why does In-N-Out get the thumbs up of approval by every single
you know, sustainable food person. They're like, my one exception is In-N-Out. What is it? The way they pay
the
worker?
They make a tasty burger.
They very tasty. It is made from scratch.
Okay.
It's grilled fresh in front of you.
I'd like to talk about the artisans at White Castle. Okay? Okay, on the steam grill with the onions and why the burgers have holes in them because they cook faster. I mean, this is the thing. This is not fast food, White Castle. You can be waiting there for a long time if you're, like, drunk on a, you know, Saturday night.
How many of those tiny burgers do you have to eat?
I have just, after many years of research, okay, the vomit threshold in most humans is 7. That's where it's at, okay, for now. Now as I'm getting a little older, it's like, it's become 5 or 6. It's
sort of
the top end. But I mix it because I get like a double cheeseburger, you know, the White Castle double cheeser, which is like, I call it the meat petit four because of the way it's layered. It's poetry in Greece.
I do like that White Castle uses the Impossible Burger. Libby, you're about to ask. The Royal Warren allows a business.
Does the royal family get money off of this when they endorse it? Do they get part of the money?
Wouldn't be surprised.
No, I doubt it.
Do they get royalties?
Oh, very nice.
I'm not usually
good at this. Why was it called Vanilla Zen? What type of name is that? Is she very calm?
I'm a big fan of seltzer. It's the champagne of water, as I like to say. And when you go to a restaurant that you don't know, the first and best and cheapest way to distinguish yourself from the masses is to be like, no regular water, please. No tap. Sparkling. For $5, you get a new glass. They're like, table 2 is a seltzer table. And then the rest, you can just be like a regular person. But it sets you apart. You get a different glass. Everyone's like, they're different. And it tastes better. It is the champagne of water. So I'm a big seltzer fan. It is ridiculous that they would invest in a Meghan Markle themed project when she already has her own basically royal.
Someone did not do their market research because that apparently was the royal warrant was given back in 2017, and all of their cars, every way that they travel, the private plane, it all has the water already stocked.
And yet here we are talking about it.
All right, fair enough.
Well, no, we're trying to help Poland Spring so the guy doesn't get totally fired. But I love it. I saw a thing on PBS about it covered many of the businesses that had the royal warrant. So meaning they're allowed to put the royal seal on all of their things. It's like a guy who makes shoes, a guy that, you know, a tailor who makes suits. I would love to royal warrant wildlife. So every wildlife is protected by the crown, like in the old medieval times where there was the crown and the serfs. And so that way you can't overhunt, you know, because even animals carry the royal seal.
Especially the royal seal.
The royal seal. Club a sandwich, not a seal.
That's right. Club sandwiches, not seals.
Yeah, club sandwiches, not seals.
Oh, funny. All right. Well, is it your birthday? It's Emily's birthday.
No, wait. I skipped it.
Sorry. Jumped ahead.
No, we got to stay. This is a hard topic. We can't jump through this
one. Okay. The James Beard Foundation announced last week that it's changing its rules and regulations in an effort to make the awards more inclusive and to counter critics who say the organization has not done enough to fight race and gender imbalances in the restaurant industry. What do you think?
I think they're topping from the bottom. All right, deal with that. I think we talked about this. It's like the Academy Awards. I want to see more diversity in the restaurants themselves, not by the people who give the awards. You know, I think that's important to see, obviously, more women, more people of color, more, you know, more diversity across the board in restaurants, you know, at the grill, in the front of the house, wherever it takes, so, you know, and not try to, like, mandate it from basically an award ceremony. And I think that's the same problem in Hollywood.
But I think then what also happened when this was announced and just prior to it was that they're now making categories that are specific to women. And what are they going to do? Make a category specific to black chefs? You know, the women who were nominated for these awards don't want them.
It's a much lazier way of dealing with the problem. I think the James Beard Awards are a joke. You have
there goes ours.
You have to pay. You have
goodbye.
You know they have a media category. We're no longer eligible.
You have to pay to be considered? What kind of quality thing is that? You don't have to pay to win an award if you have the best quality. And this is just another sign of ridiculous. I'm a huge fan of affirmative action because that is promoting people into the positions that they have been kind of pushed against. But to award, to say this is the best restaurant in the world because it has the best tasting food, and then you're like, poor woman, you know, then that doesn't make any sense. I think what they need to do is have projects, charities,
scholarships
try to get things to change, but not to just be like, we have a black award. I mean, that doesn't help the problem. And I think it's kind of maybe paternalistic or something like that. It's certainly not great.
Yeah, my only involvement with the James River Foundation is that the winery is doing a scholarship these days. The past couple of years, it's I think it's $10,000, something like that, to either a food or a wine student. So we had we've been doing like a guest chef series at the winery once a year where we bring somebody who has got an affiliation with the James Beard House in, and we talk about the scholarship and try and promote it. Because I'm totally with you. I think that makes way more sense. I know Dominique Crenn keeps getting snubbed and getting the, you know, the women award instead of actually just winning the award. Mm-hmm. So I don't know what their changes were exactly, but I think they certainly need something.
And then also I see who gets nominated. It's something like 400 restaurants, 800. They're like, we've whittled it down to 700 restaurants in the Pacific Northwest. All those people paid. And then also, if the same chef won a lot, like, you know, Jean-Georges won 6 out of the past 10 years, I would really respect it. Because you're like, yes, they're truly going on the best. What they're looking for is like Time Out's top 10. It's a different top 10 all the time. It's a kind of like who's hot. The other thing about, I want Michelin guy. Where
the other
like,
thing
this
that they do
stars.
Is it's done by region. And I think now, and something we've talked about a lot in the show, is chefs are leaving the coast. They're leaving LA. They're leaving San Francisco. They're leaving New York. They're going back to maybe the cities that they're from, Minneapolis, Philadelphia, Charleston. And so I think that these regional categories are going to become harder. But there was a long period of time where, you know, Andrea Rusling, who has a restaurant I love in North Carolina called Lantern, she won every single year because that category was weak.
Yeah,
know?
Well, if you're in a region with
that's
very few
saying.
Great restaurants, it's unfair.
So I don't know. Should it not be regional? Should it be...
We brought up the same thing for the Good Food Awards. Antonio from Nduya is competing with 800 artisans. Meanwhile, the guy in North Dakota, in his little region, or maybe not North Dakota, Wyoming or something, is competing with no one. So you could make a really mediocre product and be a finalist.
I'm always suspect of award shows anyway. I mean, I don't like the Academy Awards. I never
Why?
Watch them. Well, first of all, I don't need to be reminded that there's an aristocracy in this country, which is what it seems to me it's all about. But also, it's just self-serving for the industry. I mean, it's very
it's
insular.
Great. These are artists. I like it.
I mean,
I love hearing artists tell their kids to go to sleep.
I hear artists thank their agents and the producers. No, I think it's very self-serving. And it's designed to promote the industry. I don't think it's necessarily the goal is to promote good art.
But there is the 10th anniversary of HRN next year, and we are talking about a legitimate award show. I think
like
chefs,
the Slammies, like the wrestling award
the
show.
The Hammies. We do think chefs deserve a really reputable award. Plus, people who are executive directors of the James Beard Award are in jail for stealing. It's all a crock. It's pay to play. And who do you know? And I think chefs deserve a legitimate award that like Al Gore and President Obama are on, you know, the panel of things like that, based off of sustainability and quality.
Okay. Right. Now well, that will be stay tuned this. Until next year.
When White Castle gets an award, I'll tune in.
Steve, do you have anything to say?
What bothers me at the James Beard Awards is that it's money driven, that there should be a way to make it more transparent, which I think they become. But if we're going to honor chefs, it should not have so much politics and money involved behind the scenes.
They're like, this is the best restaurant in LA. Who paid us $500 to consider them? I mean, come on.
All right, are we ready for this one? Is it your birthday? It is Emily's birthday today.
Happy birthday to you. We got a happy birthday song.
Are you
going to
take a solo for this, Patrick?
He's been warming up his vocal cords.
All right, or is it just a regular weekday that could use a sweet celebration? The iconic Three Musketeers chocolate bar is introducing its first new variety in 6 years, birthday cake flavor. The long milk chocolate covered candy bar looks the same on the outside, but inside features vanilla flavored nougat dotted with celebratory colorful sprinkles. What do you think about birthday flavors, birthday cakes, birthday candy?
Boo.
Oh, shoot.
What is birthday cake flavor, really?
Yeah.
It's sugar. It's sweet, right? It's
pure sugar and sprinkles.
I think it has to have sprinkles. Yeah. I think that's where
but
it comes from.
But sprinkles don't have a flavor.
Yeah, that's true.
It's a weird thing. I don't really get it. Is it... It's a vanilla cake. You get frosting, sprinkles.
Yeah, what am I, 3 years old?
I think it's more of like a flavor memory. I don't know how to describe that, but there is this thing that we think of as birthday cake. True. I'm an ice cream cake girl.
Yeah, I mean, I'm in favor of birthdays. Ooh, I'm in favor of parties, but the birthday cake flavor, there's like no love in it. There's no There's no technique.
There's no there flavor. There.
Yeah, exactly. There you go. Exactly.
I don't like rituals, you know, like things like, for instance, at weddings.
Really?
Beautiful women all of a sudden like add hair to their hair. And they dress, they do different things. And likewise, it's not my favorite dessert. If it was my favorite dessert, I would have birthday cake all the time. It's never as good as like my favorite kind of chocolate chip cookies and whatnot. So I think people should treat rites of passages as regular days and treat regular days as rites of passage. And you should get your favorite foods, not some special food that looks spectacular, but isn't as good as the Three Musketeers.
I'm with this. I remember when I was like 8 years old, my mom said, "What do you want for a birthday cake?" And I said, "Actually, I'd prefer a pizza."
Yeah, that's the best.
And she looked at me like I was weird.
She's
but,
like, "You're gonna get duck breasts."
I don't want to. I hate that white frosting. I don't like that stupid, you know, sugar cake like you're talking about. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't care how many layers it's got or what nice message you wrote on it. Bring me a pizza.
I had an early birthday party on Sunday, and three friends, instead of bringing any kind, I didn't want gifts, and they brought me cheese. They brought me multiple types of cheese. They know it's my favorite food. They know I always have a good cheese platter. Mm-hmm. And I was handed three bags of just freshly cut cheese.
How about cheesecake? Birthday cheesecake.
That works. At my wedding, I tried to do wheels of cheese instead of a wedding cake.
And I won't bore the panel with the details, but when I asked Max to give me my favorite Thomas the Train salty, and he gives me birthday salty, which is salty with like confetti on his face, I get so mad. I want real salty.
I don't know what you're talking about. No one does. I don't really like Three Musketeers to begin with. I like Twix.
Really? Twix?
Three Musketeers is just a nougat. It was like
one-dimensional.
I know as a kid, Three Musketeers was my favorite candy.
Three Musketeers?
Yep. Steve got really excited about this
I like
one.
Milky Ways.
I remember that birthday party you had, Patrick, where the stripper jumped out of the cake.
Yes.
And then she hurt you and jumped back in the cake.
Yes, I know. She was rough.
Elizabeth, you'll be happy to know there's a new Twix flavor coming out, too. There's lots of new candies on the market. Okay, we have a strong West Coast team in the room today. So Brandon's not with us today, but he just opened Roberta's in L.A. Jeff is the chef at Robert Mondavi Winery in Oakville in the Napa Valley. Steve is a longtime meat distributor in L.A. as well. Myself, Patrick, Mike are New Yorkers. Libby, she's from Boston, but that's okay.
Welcome. We're not talking about Boston.
So, L.A., San Fran, New York. Define what you think of each place culinarily speaking. When you hear L.A., San Francisco, or New York and food, what do you say to people?
Yeah, like dinner party kind of conversation. So what do you say?
For me, if I think of New York, I think of pizza and bagels. And then if I think of the sort of fancy restaurants in New York, I think of refinement and technique. And then if I think of San Francisco, I think of fresh produce. I think of really seasonal kind of cooking on the simpler side, but you know, emphasis on quality. And if I think of L.A., I think of...
Shithole?
Yeah.
No, just kidding.
I think of Korean food, honestly,
tacos?
Is like the first thing that comes to mind. Tacos, exactly. Like I think a lot of international influence in L.A.,
but it is becoming a city too, right? Of culinary, like of refinement and produce,
sure.
Also, right?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, LA's huge, so there's like all sorts of different things there. But yeah, there's a bunch of nice restaurants in LA for sure.
Steve, is there a special type of pizza in LA, or it's only?
Yeah, it has a pineapple on it, and Wolfgang Puck makes it.
Oh God!
So LA, nope. Tell us when someone's like, "What's happening in LA?" What do you answer?
LA offers every ethnicity on the face of the earth. When it comes to restaurants, you could have every type of food imaginable. This restaurant scene has become very different. A lot of chefs are coming into the LA area to open up restaurants, a lot of because the real estate is more approachable than other cities. But there's just a real boom going on as far as other chefs coming in, realizing the produce that's in our backyard that's, you know, uncomparable to other places in the country.
Mm-hmm. So, Steve, what's the new thing that people are ordering? Is there like a cut or something that's hot these days in L.A.?
It's a good question.
Jeff's going to steal it for the winery. Watch out.
That's right. Yeah, I need a new idea.
But he will buy it through Premier.
No, I don't know. Every chef today is trying to reinvent, you know, what they're serving and stay ahead of the next guy. And it's just very interesting how chefs today have to always promote themselves to stay ahead and stay fresh.
So it's more about promoting themselves than promoting a new cool cut of meat? Or?
I think so.
You know what I was thinking?
What's a new cut?
How about a pork skirt steak?
That's true.
Or, I don't know, last year Bon Appetit put out I remember you sent me a picture and you said it was the middle chop. It was taking the loin chop and extending it through the belly into the rib. And that was like the cool thing. But it was a pain in the ass for chefs to actually cook. You couldn't get it crispy just in time for service. You know, it was something that was more for a photo and less for dining. But I don't know. Is there an it thing?
There really isn't, other than, you know, a hanger steak or the flat iron that's, you know, become so popular. And
how many cows do they have to kill to supply the LA restaurant scene with hanger steak every? Doesn't a cow only produce like
about five pounds?
Yeah.
About 5 pounds on a steer.
Wow.
And, you know, when you ask the question, the difference between LA, I think, to me, what I was thinking is, like, in New York, you could walk down the street and get something great to eat, you know? But in LA, no one walks, and every restaurant, therefore, is a destination. And I think that's entirely changes, like, the character and the style of restaurants. And when I'm in LA and I say to my friends, hey, let's all go out to dinner, you know, where do you want to meet? And, you know, let's go to, you know, Pizza Mozza. I know a guy over there, you know? And they say, no, we're not going to West Hollywood. This guy lives in Silver Lake. Someone else lives in, you know, wherever, Pasadena, Santa Monica. You know, who the fuck knows? Because it is so spread out. There's no real central downtown. And so we have to compromise geographically, you know, which means a compromise gastronomically as well. And I end up eating in some place I don't like because it's convenient for five people, you know, from various points to get to some imaginary equidistant position that they have
that
to drive to.
In New York. I have friends on the Upper East Side who just had babies, but they won't come to Brooklyn.
So, but you know what? But if you picked a restaurant in Greenwich Village or Chelsea, everybody would meet there without a question. Mm-hmm. You can go to, you say, let's just meet downtown, and they would be there.
Okay. Mike is just sore because he tried to launch a bicycle delivery business in San Francisco and in Los Angeles. And neither of them
it was downhill in both directions. But I think, you know, last time I was in L.A., seriously. And then we had dinner at a bad place. And I was like, great, let's go for a drink. And everybody's like, what are you talking about? We just parked our cars. We're not doing that again. And the night was over. And to me, that's kind of the drives the L.A. dining experience because of driving and valet parking and also being, you know, somewhat sober to get back on the road. Mm-hmm. It's not the same as New York where you hop in a cab or you just walk home or to the subway.
It's so many generalizations. I mean, it's such a big question, but it's really interesting. Like San Francisco, I get the sense, or Napa even, very few chefs from the outside go in. Whereas in L.A., a lot of people are going in. San Francisco is like a homespun group of people. You don't, like, Italy will probably not launch in San Francisco too soon. Or Danny Meyer would be like, San Francisco. Whereas in L.A., he could open 100 Shake Shacks right away. That's one thing. I also think L.A. is a lot like New York. The people, the energy, whereas San Francisco is not at all. So the food scene is closer to LA and New York is similar, but maybe in San Francisco it's its own little top of the pyramid unique spot, because the produce isn't better in San Francisco than it is in LA, is it? And yet somehow San Francisco is associated with that, in LA almost not at all.
I mean, from my experience, people in Northern California, and maybe it's like this in LA too, but there's a lot of people that care about what they're eating. They will pay a little bit more because they believe you when you tell them that this produce really just came from an hour away from this farm. Mm-hmm. And I think that drives the food scene there quite a bit. I also think in regards to like other people moving in, the San Francisco market is pretty saturated.
Oh.
Like there's lots of restaurants in San Francisco and people open new spots, but people don't usually want to go to like you're saying, like somebody coming from New York to open something that already exists in New York. Mm-hmm. People are trying to open like more unique spots in San Francisco. I think there's lots of like little restaurants and you know, different, culturally different and, you know, interesting. I don't know. I think it would be hard for somebody to bring like their concept from another big city into San Francisco.
Right. Well, do you get annoyed when you in the Valley get thrown in with San Francisco? Because really you have very little to do with it, right? In terms of, I mean, you're an hour and a half away and all that.
I mean, I love San Francisco. I lived there for a number of years. I like the food scene. Some of the purveyors are the same, so I don't really mind getting lumped in with them. Things are definitely a little bit slower, a little bit more laid back in Napa for sure. You know, we're able to have a nice garden right at the winery where we can literally walk out the door and get a bunch of the food that we're going to serve people that day, or they can dine out in the garden, that sort of thing. So that's an aspect that I like that's not really in the city.
I've come up with a new way of grouping that entire region together, which everybody loves, NorCal. I came up with that about 10 years ago, and I love it. Well, Steve, I want to ask you.
It's like the Nolita of the West.
You were talking about L.A. You work with chefs every day, hundreds of them. You're the top salesperson at Premier Meats, one of the top in the nation. You move more sustainable meat than almost anyone. How do you sell meat successfully in this city as dynamic and as large as Los Angeles?
It's by staying in tune to what's happening at the moment. I mean, with the food scene, it's constantly changing. You just have to really be on top of the game, it's always connected.
What do you mean connected? You go visit the restaurants all the time?
Go visit the restaurants. My phone's on 24/7, so I'm always there to lend support to the chefs.
What do they call you for? They're like, get me a short rib delivery or my...
How much is this? How much is that? You know, can you get me this in the next hour? You know, and this is 7 days a week that it goes on.
How many restaurants are you really responsible for?
I service myself 75 restaurants.
Wow, 75.
Yeah.
And they buy all different types of meats from you?
They do, of course.
It's a lot of late night texts you get.
Yes, I do. I keep very long hours.
And are people upset? Or is it a high maintenance crew over there, like I imagine New York to be?
No, I try to. I've been doing it so long to handpick who I'm servicing, and there's a lot of high maintenance chefs out there that I do try to avoid. But it's the type of business that there are certain chefs that absolutely appreciate what you do, and it's just very satisfying to be able to do a job and to be so appreciated.
Well, we very seldom get someone from as far away as Los Angeles, and you've been a meat distributor there since, according to this, 1945.
Well, not exactly. I'm actually fourth generation in the meat business in Los Angeles. I've been involved since the mid-70s.
Wow. I was born in 72. That's amazing. So tell us about L.A., how it's changed over the 30 years, 40
just
years.
The food scene or what we think about when we go out to eat has changed so drastically. I mean, I can remember growing up, if I went out to eat, it would be for an occasion. Now when you go out to eat, it's more of an everyday event, and it's a way to be entertained. It's best way I could sum it up. Mm-hmm. Good example, when we had the crash in 08, I mean, I think the restaurant business, it's fairly recession-proof. We had horrible times in 08, yet still people were going out to eat because they wanted the escape. They wanted to be entertained. They wanted to have some normality to their lives. So I just really think that you know, the whole restaurant scene, it's just become a more accepted way.
It's what they say, right? When times are bad, you go to a bar. When times are good, you go to a bar.
Well, you know, that's the Hollywood model. It's why there's so many great movies made during the Depression. Because it's because people went all the time because it was entertaining. They had to get the hell out of the house and, you know, live in another world.
I think it also opens the door to maybe it opened fast casual to be a little bit more popular or a little bit more elevated where ingredients mattered. Where, I don't know, you're asking about the In-N-Out burger, but someone else is doing a burger that has quality ingredients and is also quick. You know, so
Fast casual has become a very, very big component, especially in the L.A. area with the cost of wages going up. They need to figure out ways to lower their costs and be able to serve people.
Well, we will very happy. I know you, speaking of gastronomy, great gastronomy historically, you're off to the Tenement Museum, which was famous for great food.
Oh,
that's
great. You could pay $30 to see the apartment I lived in 1982.
But from the New Yorkers here, you should go to Russ and Daughters. You should get a knish at Jonah Schimmel's right on Houston.
You'll be a block from each.
Get a hot dog at Katz's. I still swear Katz's is the best dog in New York. And make sure you get one from the back of the grill that's been on there for a while.
It's a pure breed dog over
there. Basically, you need to go have like four meals in the next hour.
Snacks. So thank you, Steve. We're going to take our break, and then we're going to come back and interview Jeff Mosher about one of the most important spots, culinarily speaking, in American history, Robert Mondavi Winery.
Your car's outside.
My name is Brandon Hoy, co-owner of Roberta's, a super duper awesome place. Roberta's is a very, 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 very proud sponsor
of the Heritage Radio Network. We're also super awesome. Thank you, Heritage.
All right, we are back. This is the main course, OG.
At Roberta's in Bushwick, live on the Heritage Radio Network.
In Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm Patrick Martins.
I'm Libby.
You guys are like tag team champions. I was like, real mic skills there. You might be up for a slammy with that kind of pattern.
Who is the greatest tag team duo in wrestling
history? First of all, that's redundant because tag teams are duos necessarily. But I would have to say, if I had to pick one, I think the Road Warriors. My personal favorites may be the Wild Samoans, Afa and Sika. But I think the Road Warriors really changed the game.
Did Hillbilly Jim have a companion and they were...
Well, I don't know what your obsession with these babyface hillbillies are. I never went for that, you know? They're not my kind of people.
My middle name is Captain Lou. I'm not a babyface.
See, when Captain Lou made him a good guy, to me that was like the most glaring example of Reagan-era culture death. Mm-hmm. You know, he was a bad guy.
That was one of the worst
things. Him and
ever.
Fred Blassie and the Grand Wizard of Wrestling. But anyway, let's talk about food.
All right. Well, the chef of one of America's most important gastronomic landmarks, Robert Mondavi Winery. I don't say that lightly. I mean, that is important. That was the center of Napa and the American wine scene, which is really the first time we became a global headquarters. And we actually were making better wine than they were in like Barolo and Barbaresco at the time. Then they got wise to the shitty wine they were making and how much culture they had lost. So Napa really elevated so much. So, Jeff, thanks for coming.
You're welcome. Happy to be here.
Tell us about Robert and Margaret Mondavi. And also what Napa Valley means to you.
You know, like you said, I think Robert Mondavi had a lot of influence on making Napa Valley what it is today. You know, when he started his winery, there were, you know, 30 wineries, 50 wineries in Napa Valley, and now there's about 500. And he was always sort of trying to push innovation, you know, using stainless steel tanks or fermenting in giant wood barrels. And, you know, he really liked Sauvignon Blanc. He liked... you know, Blanc Fumé from the Loire region, but people that were making a Fumé Blanc in America, it was a sweet wine. And so he wanted to try and make a version of that was dry, but he had to change the name. So that's where he got Fumé Blanc, was to make a dry Sauvignon Blanc. So he was always changing stuff, and he was always, you know, the other cool thing is that he was always, he wasn't keeping it secrets. He was like, share his ideas, because one of his thoughts was that if you're copying what I did yesterday, you're not seeing what I'm doing today. You know, so he's always trying to stay ahead. And really had a huge influence in the valley, and was also just a super nice man, and very generous, very gregarious. And Margaret is the one who really started, you know, what she had the biggest effect on what I do there now, because she's the one who started the sort of the hospitality side of the winery, started the concert series. Next year is going to be the 50th anniversary of the Robert Mondavi concert series. She was the one that brought in the chefs, and she was the one that started, you know, meals, which just sort of started out as the family having lunch, or, you know, the winemakers having lunch, that sort of thing, and then blossomed into their great chefs program in the 80s and 90s, where they would bring in chefs first from France, you know, ridiculously famous chefs. They would have, you know, Jacques Pepin, or, you know, Julia Child, Thomas Keller, and they would have them right there in the kitchen and cook for a small group of people, you know, 15 people, something like that. And so we still have a mirror in the kitchen, you know, like a demo mirror that hangs over the tables in the kitchen from when they used to do that. But I think it was probably kind of expensive. And these days, it's not something that we do. But But we try and carry on, you know, the spirit of Bob and Margaret, and you know, it's all about hospitality for us there. It's not necessarily, you're not going to get a 12-course tasting menu, but you're going to get food that's made, you know, with good ingredients and made with some intention, and you know, it's going to be good with the wine.
What does food look like there now? So I'm embarrassed to say I haven't been. I've actually never been to the Napa Valley. So do I come and have dinner? Is it only for special events? Are you guys open every day?
Yeah, I mean, we're there every day, but it's all by appointment. So it's either the public can come to a couple different programs. You can sign up, you know, at the winery on the website. There's a lunch program a couple days a week, and there's in the summer, or in May through October, we do a garden-to-table dinner where we bring about 12 people into the garden, pick vegetables, and then go and prepare them by the wood grill and the wood oven outside, and then they sit down to like a fun family-style meal. But we also do a lot of just sort of catered events. We do a lot of internal stuff, and then a lot of the business we do is we do meals and tours and tastings for people that we do business with. So like Steve from LA, mm-hmm. He could come up and, you know, if I was buying meat from him and, you know, we would set him up with a lunch or dinner or something like that. Or, you know, if you own a liquor store in Brooklyn and you tell your sales rep that you're going to be coming to California in October, and he's like, all right, well, you got to go to Robert Mondavi. Let me set you up there. And then they come and they have an experience. Part of it that sort of sets it apart is that there's an educational component to everything mm-hmm. There. Like almost all the meals are hosted. So there's somebody from the winery that's hanging out with you and talking to you about the history of the winery, talking to you about the wines, talking to you about the food. You know, I always come out and talk to every group, you know, just about what we're doing and in what they had and that sort of thing.
That's interesting. I think that also links that hospitality theme that you're talking about that was so important and so, I guess, started by Margaret. But it's coming full circle and it keeps it all going.
It's funny. I mean, the Mondavi's had this dual side, or Robert did, because, I mean, on one level, you say he was such a nice guy and he started all this hospitality things with his wife, and it was a center where millions of people came and tasted, and yet he himself was a tough cookie with some of the people he worked with. So it was a kind of dichotomy of energy. But you as the chef, did they, like, you were the chef of their food museum, right? Copia?
Yep. Yeah, I was a chef at Julia's Kitchen at Copia for a couple of years. I worked there from 2004 to 2008.
It was the world's first food museum, basically.
Yeah. There was a museum component. There was a demonstration kitchen, a movie theater. You know, Julia's Kitchen was the fine dining restaurant. We had a 2.5-acre organic garden on the property that guests could wander through and visit. And we, you know, there we got probably almost like 70% of the produce that we used in the restaurant. And we were doing a couple hundred covers a day. So it was a substantial amount.
That's my image of you, is walking through the gardens and picking the stuff.
Didn't the Mondavi's also like help popularize wine drinking in a mainstream way in the 70s? Yeah. I mean, I seem to see him everywhere, Robert Mondavi, kind of this Orwellian figure, you know, talking about wine at a time where I don't think a lot of Americans are very hip or knowledgeable about wine.
Well, actually, I think it was early on they were making very good wine. I think history might look back at his late career decision to try to make wine be twist off and served at every deli, not deli, but, you know, really be like beer. That was their problem. If they had stayed making great wine, maybe the family would still be more involved with the winery. I don't know. That was a big thing. Do you make wine for the masses or do you make great wine?
Yeah, well, you need to differentiate between Robert Mondavi Winery, which is the winery that he started in 1966, and it's its own entity. And then, like, you're talking about Woodbridge or Robert Mondavi Private Selection, mm-hmm. Which are actually different wineries. You know, they're made in different places.
I was about to ask, how can you possibly produce enough for the way that we see it?
6 million cases or something like that. Whereas Mondavi makes a couple hundred thousand, which is still a substantial amount. Like, it's a pretty big winery for Napa Valley, but they're still making, you know, fine wine. Wine, you know, they used to always say, you know, wine that can be held in the company of the best wines in the world. Mm-hmm. But I mean, the other thing, you know, you're saying that Robert Mondavi is a tough cookie. You know, one thing that everybody always says about him, especially in, you know, the early years, which the early years are, you know, he was still, you know, an older man. He started the winery when he was 50, but he was extremely hard worker. You know, he was always out on the road, you know, promoting his wine, selling the wine. And I think that's where, you know, he gets sort of the tough reputation. Mm-hmm. So I think he was tough, but it was because he wanted quality.
Yeah. Well, I'd be remiss to have somebody so closely affiliated with the Mondavis without telling the story. I was working for Slow Food in 1999, and I knew I was trying to raise enough money to launch the U.S. branch of Slow Food. And Carlo Petrini and the guys there never thought I would really raise enough members or money to say I deserve a U.S. office. So I met Michael Mondavi at Vinitaly. There was a big conference there, theater, opera, something like that, classical music. And I walked up to him in his box and I was like, hi, I'm with Slow Food. And I, you know, gave him a 30-second little spiel before like security dragged me out of there. And about 6 months or a year later, I got a lovely handwritten card from him that said, it was such a pleasure to meet you. I'm a big fan of Slow Food. I learned about it while I was in Italy. And sure enough, when I first needed my huge sum of money, which at the time was, you know, $25,000 or something, to fly all of the chapter leaders in the U.S. to Bolinas for our first meeting, Clay Gregory, who was running the winery at the time, actually through Michael, got us the money. And all the Slow Food people were amazed. I sent out an email to all the leaders being like, we raised the money. I got it all through Robert Mondavi Winery. And everyone was like, holy shit, he did. So awesome. Slow Food in the U.S. was really started in many ways by Michael. And I met Michael and Robert Mondavi and his wife one time at Chez Panisse's 30th anniversary. And they were very warm. And she was really, you know, a classy lady. So... Well, last question.
I mean, yeah. Are you raising money for us to all fly there?
No, this was Slow Food. 1999.
If anyone would like to call in, we're doing a GoFundMe for us to visit.
To get you to Bolinas. It was really funny. The buses had never been to Bolinas. We had 4 charter buses. And to get to Bolinas, it is a curvy road. Mm-hmm. And they had never been there. We stayed at Susie Buell's house. I think she started Esprit, and she hosted us there. And Chez Panisse cooked. It was really, really great. So what brings you to New York this week?
So I'm here on behalf of the winery. We did, this is actually my day off. I just finished my events, but I came in Sunday and I did an event at the Garden City Hotel in Long Island on Tuesday and an event at Woodpecker last night, both David Burke restaurants. So I worked with David to come up with the menu and then we, you know, I executed it with his different teams and they were all with Mondavi Wines. You know, the fun thing about this one was that we brought some older vintages, so people got to try the, you know, the current Cab Reserve 2015, but also the 05, which was showing really well. So that was that was really well received by the guests. I'll tell you one funny thing about it. I don't know if you know, David Burke is a pretty, you know, he's an interesting guy. He's his food's very like whimsical, and there's a lot of sort of thought into it. But so we're making the menu, right? We're talking on the phone and I'm like, I want to do this dish and this dish. And he's like, that all sounds fantastic. What would you like us to do? I'm like, well, why don't you guys do dessert? And so he's like, okay, we'll come up with something. And then, you know, a couple days later, he shoots me a text. He's like, dessert's going to be a pair of pears. I'm like, a pair of pears. Okay, fine.
At least it wasn't birthday cake.
Yeah. And so that's on the menu, right? And then I'm like, fine, they've got it dialed in. And I get here and I'm at the Garden City Hotel and the chef's like, so tell me about your pair of pears dessert. And I'm like, I don't know. That's David's idea. I don't know what you're talking about. And so then, you know, later the pastry chef comes up and he's like, what's this pair of pears? Nobody knows. Right. No, he didn't tell anybody what it was. And I get this when I go to Woodpecker, too. That guy doesn't know either. Nobody has any idea. And the chef there, Carmine, he's like, you know what David does sometimes? He comes up with the name of a dish and then he just backs the dish into it. So the chefs of the different properties, they just have to come up with it. And they're like,
I'll
all right,
provide
well,
the headlines, you provide the war.
So wow. what was a pair of pears? Eventually?
Well, it was different at the two different places because one guy made one thing, one guy made another thing.
So all right. Did you have to name your dishes with whimsical names?
No, not at all. My dishes were like sautéed scallop with pickled finger lime. And
you're not saying it. Goat.
I was about to say.
Well, we did the goat.
Yes,
too, of course.
Goat.
Yes.
No goat left behind. Goat-tober, saving male dairy goats.
We were
dairy
so
farms.
Honored.
I did tell them all the story.
You weaved in
yeah.
Goat-tober.
Everybody
you
liked
were
it,
about
it
to
really
leave
well
a
received.
Kid behind and not mention it.
Actually, he had two.
Two goats.
Yes.
So now the goats here were spectacular. Or no, the goats in the valley were spectacular. These two didn't come in fantastic. We could talk about this
off
the
air. The goat dish came out really well. It was we braised it with tomatoes and white wine and then served it with potato gnocchi, some charred Brussels sprouts, some parm. It was like a really simple dish but really nice flavors. It was with the Pinot Noir and it was fun because there were sort of two groups of people. There were, you know, because we talked about it with all the guests and the staff and whatever, and there's one group of people, which is the much larger group, that had really never had goat and didn't know what it was going to taste like, and were, some of them were kind of apprehensive. But basically, everybody got it, and then everybody loved it. They were like, oh, wow, it's such like a smooth flavor. It's not like super gamey. And
the Trumpian in the table was like, am I going to become a Muslim?
Yeah. But then the other group of people were people that had grown up eating it like all their lives, and they were like surprised and shocked to see it on, you know, this sort of fancy wine menu. But they really liked it, too. Like, everybody liked it, but they just, there were sort of two different groups that...
Is goat more eaten in Northern California or basically not at all as well?
Yeah, not at all as well, except for the few restaurants that might get it from you guys.
There is an anti-goat faction in America that needs to be stomped out.
Yeah, well, that would be basically the entire country. Someone from Huffington Post asked us the per capita, you know, how much goat meat is consumed in the U.S. each year.
Yeah, like, per person?
Probably not that much.
But is it because in Europe they drink like goat milk, and then I was just in Ireland, they had goat cheese everywhere, and it was so fresh and so good. So maybe you're like, oh, well, you're eating all these goat products, why not just have the meat as well here?
It's a good point, Libby, because Goat-tober here in the U.S. has remained a whimsical little quirky project. Then it went to England, where they're raising millions of pounds of goat cheese, and there was a real need for that. Yeah. So.
Oh, the goat cheese over there was amazing.
Should be all right.
Birthday gift. How about the whiskey? Oh, yeah. I've heard good things.
Whiskey? Yeah. Apparently she drank a lot of Irish coffee.
One thing that's on the topic of goats for a second. Gamey, the word gamey has this negative connotation. And when I eat goat, I want it to be strong flavor. I want to taste goat. Otherwise, I'd eat a cow I mean, there's nothing wrong with it. I love beef. I love pork. But when I eat a goat, I want it to taste like a goat. I want it to have that. And gamey, I know it's a negative thing, but I do want that little bit of like funk on it, a little bit of like power.
That makes sense.
I make goat chili, and I do that because I want the goat meat to power through my chili. And give it that thing.
All right, I'm going to give one little plug for Goat-tober. It is going all month. You can find out more information at goattober.us. There's a list of all the events that are happening in the U.S. and actually internationally as well through the end of the month. And we have two special events in New York next week, one on Wednesday the 17th at Claro in Brooklyn, and the other one is Thursday the 18th at Huertas in the East Village. You can reserve tickets online, goattober.us, and there's about 40 restaurants around the country participating, including Robert Mondavi Winery.
A by-appointment-only restaurant, but it is worth going. It is, to be a personal shameless plug, you're going to Napa Valley, it's a wedding, or, you know, it's a group of friends, your family, and you make the appointment there, and you get a private tour of the winery, you do all the vertical flights of all the wines, you eat in the vineyard, overlooking the spectacular valley, you know, Jeff is there.
Just tell them Jeff invited you.
With Mike Stillwell, right?
Chris Stillwell.
And, you know, you guys are there, and there's beehives going, and there's a team that has been there, even though it's an event space for decades. The same crew comes in all the time. It is just really special. Yeah, I know. They want to stay.
This month we do tours for hundreds of people at the winery also, just public tours. And at the end of the tour, you get a tasting, and there's always one little food item. So this month it's a goat meatball.
Tag your pictures. Hashtag Goat-tober if you're at the winery.
GoFundUs.
GoFundMe.
GoFundMe. I like that. All right.
Speaking of goats, how are the Yankees doing?
Greatest of all time? Is that what you mean?
All right. Thank you, Jeff, so much for joining us. Thank you all for listening.
My
pleasure. Next is Tech Bites at 11. Stay tuned.
Ooh, good pickup.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
V8 motor and this smart and designed black convertible top, and the gals don't mind sporting with me riding all